Well, this evening I want to draw your attention to Psalm number 44. And this evening and next Wednesday, God willing, we're going to be looking through Psalm 44. We could spend, of course, more than 2 weeks looking at the Psalm. There's quite a lot of condensed material, much of it very instructive and interesting. We could, of course, take the broad sweep and look at it on the one occasion, and indeed I was considering doing that, but there are reasons why I want to take more than one occasion to look at Psalm number 44. So we're going to look at the first half, or the first 16 verses rather, this evening, and God willing, next time we'll look at verses 17 to the end. And the reason that we want to look at this psalm in particular is because it evidently had a significance for the Apostle Paul. You remember in our recent studies in Romans chapter 8, we commented on verse 36 of that chapter in Romans, where Paul actually quotes from this psalm. And that's why I was reading in Romans chapter 8 from verse 28 again this evening, in order just to refresh our memory. Paul quotes from verse number 22, and by implication also from verse 11 of this psalm. Verse 11 says, "Thou hast given us like sheep appointed for meat." And then at verse 22 we have the statement that the Apostle Paul actually quotes and applies to our own generation, to the Christian age. "Yea, for thy sake we are killed all the day long, we are accounted as sheep for the slaughter." And you might wonder, well, why is this so important? And I think it is important because this psalm obviously was quite significant to the Apostle Paul, and he evidently found things in the psalm that were of abiding relevance for Christian people. This wasn't some ancient song applicable to Israel. Paul evidently saw there are principles in the psalm, and by implication in the whole of Scripture, but he's isolating this psalm. There's something in this psalm that Paul finds very interesting and instructive for Christians and applicable for the Christian church in all generations. And it's that general principle that I particularly want to think about as we work our way through Psalm number 44. Obviously, the apostles saw it as containing a great deal of Christian teaching and doctrine and application. Well, we're going to be looking at these first 16 verses this evening. And I want to look at these verses in three main divisions. It's sometimes handy to divide up portions of Scripture just to make it, as it were, able to be masticated and digested, as it were, and in order to encapsulate and to capture the various themes. And as we look at these first 16 verses, verses 1 to 3, we have some teaching here concerning God in the past. And then from verse 4 to 8, as we shall see, we have some statements concerning God in the present. And then from verse 9 to verse 16, we have further statements concerning God in the present suffering. And the psalmist is not just speaking about God in the present, but the sufferings of this present time, God's hand is in that also. And then, as we shall see next time, from verse 17, the psalmist is making a protestation. He says, we are suffering not because we have abandoned God. All this has come upon us, yet we have not forgotten God. And so what is so interesting about this psalm is that it should really correct our thinking once and for all, that all suffering that comes to a Christian believer or a Christian congregation must in some way be related to some specific sin. Maybe it does. Very often it does, but it need not. it may be, as we shall see next week, God willing, suffering comes to God's people not because they're unfaithful, but actually because they are faithful. And the psalmist then closes verses 23 to the end with his own response to these things, prayer to God, more frequent and more fervent prayer. But we're going to limit our attention this evening to what the psalmist says. First of all, verses 1 to 3, God in the past, 4 to 8, God in the present, and then verses 9 to 16, God in the present sufferings. Now, we don't know when this psalm was written. We don't know by whom it was written. We're told it's a psalm to the chief musician for the sons of Korah. It's a maskil, that's just a Hebrew form of poetry. These various titles, the scholars differ as to what they exactly mean. We know that a psalm, for example, was meant to be sung to a stringed instrument. Other of the musical compositions may well have been, and in fact some of them probably were intended for musical accompaniment also, but that's another argument and another sermon, you might say. But the point is, here is a composition in the book of Psalms. We don't know when it was written, we don't know by whom, but we know why it was written. And it was written because the psalmist is living in a time of distress. He is living in a time where he tells us in verse 9, where the Lord doesn't seem in the present. In certain circumstances, he's no longer going out with our armies. It doesn't look, on the face of it, as if God is in fact on our side. He seems in fact to be against us. And that seems to be the context. But the psalmist is not, as it were, discouraged. He is not losing his faith or his faithfulness. And he understands that there is something happening which in fact is going to happen to all of God's people. We are accounted all day long as sheep for the slaughter. And that's why the Apostle Paul quotes it. Because this that the psalmist is articulating here is something common to God's people. Whether we are faithful or not, it is going to happen. We are always going to be accounted as sheep for the slaughter. We'll see what that means, God willing, next time. So what can we say then, first of all, about verses 1 to 3? Well, the psalmist here is living in a time away past the events that he's recording in these opening verses. He says, "We have heard with our ears, O God. Our fathers have told us what work thou didst in their days." In other words, the psalmist is speaking about things in which he and his generation have taken no part. They know, it seems, they know nothing like this. But they have heard about these former days. And it's not just that he's hearing about something in the recent past. He's hearing of something that took place away back, many, many centuries, many generations in the past. Because he's obviously speaking about the time of the Exodus. "How thou didst drive out the heathen with thy hand and planted them, and thou didst afflict the people and cast them out. For they did not get the land in possession by their own sword, neither did by their own arm, neither was it their own arm that saved them, but it was thy right hand." So evidently the psalmist here is reflecting and remembering something that took place generations before he and indeed his immediate forebears were ever born. Now there's something very important about this, I think, and that is that we should be always ready to immerse ourselves in history. Because after all, the past determines the present. We are the fruit of the past. If the past had been different, our present would have been different. There is a continuum. And we all know that history is what the historians write about, but the past is actually what took place. But if we accept the Bible to be a true record of what actually did take place in the past, and this isn't just some kind of aggrandizing of Israel's history, then we have to face the fact that the religion of Israel, and by implication our religion, is in fact rooted in history. And the faith that we have today and the faith that the psalmist had in his generation was in fact the product, the direct consequences of things that had taken place away back centuries before he was even born. And so here the psalmist is reminding us of the importance of listening to the old stories, listening to the old men and the old women, listening to the old people who were there, who heard from their fathers and who heard from their grandfathers all the way back. And the importance simply of listening concerning where have we come from? What is the history of our religion? What is it, if anything at all, that we have to believe? What, if anything, did God do for us? Because you notice that what the psalmist is speaking about is not the great things that Israel did, or how great Israel was as a nation, or how faithful Israel was to their particular God at that ancient time. It is that he is remembering how faithful God was to his people then, and he was manifesting his faithfulness. We have heard with our ears, O God. Our fathers have told us not what they did for God, but what God did for them. What work thou didst in their days, in the times of old. And here he is speaking of those mighty events of which the prophets and the psalmists in the Old Testament, they never tired of telling the people of Israel. Moses never wearied of recounting how even in the 40 years wilderness journey, how the Lord had made the rough places smooth, the crooked places were made straight, how he had supplied water from the rock and manna from heaven, and how he had fought their battles for them. Their clothes hadn't worn out, and their shoes did not wear old upon them. And how there had been that strange experience when God was with them in the pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night, and he was speaking to them. They had heard his voice. Now, the people to whom Moses was speaking, they knew all that. They were familiar with that history. But yet Moses was going to go over it over again and again. In the book of Deuteronomy, Moses actually gives two accounts. The book of Deuteronomy is not just one sermon by Moses. It's actually two sermons where Moses gives a brief overview of the history of Israel, and then he goes back and goes over it all over again, bringing out other truths. And you find this in the psalmists and in the prophets of old. They always reminded the people of Israel that they should be faithful to God in their present circumstances, because God was faithful to them in the past, and he would give evidence of where God's faithfulness had been. He had done great things for his people. The right hand of the Lord does valiantly. That's always the basic principle. And that's always the basic pattern. And the danger is, you see, that we will, as fallen human beings, take credit for our religious history. We will sometimes, like Israel, become rather proud in our spiritual attainments and imagine for a moment that we have conquered the land. We were the ones who came into the land of Canaan. We defeated the nations. We extirpated the horrific Canaanite religion. We demolished the groves. We did it by our own right hand. And the psalmist is at pains in order to emphasize it was not. They did not get the land in possession by their own sword. Neither did their own arm save them. But it was thy right hand, he says in verse 3, and thy arm, and the light of thy countenance. It was that they were being led by God. They didn't even have to raise a sword against the city of Jericho, for example. All they had to do was obey God, march round the city for 6 days, on the seventh day go round 7 times, and the walls of Jericho fell down, according to the teaching of the scripture. They didn't conquer Jericho. It was God who conquered Jericho for them. And you may remember how in the opening chapter in the book of Joshua, for example, when Moses had died and Joshua was now to be the commander of the armies of Israel, he was to be the successor to Moses. And you remember how the Lord spoke to Joshua, and he reminded Joshua that as he had been with Moses, so I will be with you. Don't be afraid, because every soul that your foot shall step upon, I have already given it to you. In other words, it wasn't that they were to go and possess the land by conquering. The land was already given to them. All they had to do was to go in and occupy it. That was the teaching. The land already belonged to them. God had already given it over to them, even before they crossed the Jordan into the promised land. It was already their possession. And so that's the great pattern, the great picture. And as you read through the book of Joshua, you do find that there were those setbacks, there were defeats, but the setbacks and the defeats were in every single instant associated with the sin in the camp, as in Ai, for example. You remember the sin of Achan in the camp. And on those occasions when Israel seemed to be rather slow and reluctant to go on and to occupy the high ground to the north and the south, the lower ground to the south of the promised land. They occupied the central region, and it seems that they were content simply to settle down there. They had to be told, you've got to go up into the mountains of Ephraim. You've got to go down into the deserts, into the southern parts. Carry on occupying the land. And so here we're being reminded again of that ancient time, that history, where it was God doing it for them. And all they had to do was to trust and obey, and the land would be occupied by them. Now that's the general picture that the psalmist is presenting. Now there's a lesson for you and for me in all of this. Because you and I, there are times in life when we need to be reminded not only of our roots in Israel, because we are the true Israel of God. We are the heirs of the faith of Abraham, and indeed the faith of God's people right from the very beginning. But also, especially, our roots in the New Testament. Because just as God did great things for his people in the Old Testament times, that they could immediately see as being connected to them, so we as Christian people, we can look back to events that took place some 20 centuries ago, when again God, with a mighty outstretched arm, he did mighty works in the coming of Christ, the demonstration in the miracles and the signs that Jesus Christ was able to perform in his death and in his resurrection, that final victory over death. These are events. And if you remove these events from your thinking, you're removing the foundations. And any religion that is built upon a shonky or shabby foundation is going to collapse. Digging deep, that rock that our Lord Jesus Christ speaks about in the Sermon on the Mount is not only hearing and doing, it's not only the doing of his word, it's the hearing of it. And it means that we have a grasp. I'm not saying that every Christian believer is to be an expert in history, but I am saying that we must know something of our history, just as the people in Israel, they had to know not only who they were, but why they were what they were, and how come that they are in the present condition that they find themselves in at any particular juncture. How come that they're in the land of promise at all? How did they end up there? They weren't always there. How did it happen? And in the same way, we as Christian people, we need to have a firm grasp in these great foundational truths that God has done for us great things, but also the subsequent history. What has happened over the past 20 centuries? I'm sure that many of us may be rather skillful and familiar with the Reformation history, for example. But what about the 1500 years of Christian history before the Reformation came? What about the Eastern Church? We're familiar with the Western Church, the Protestant and the Roman Catholic divide. But what about the Eastern Church? What about the church in Africa? What about the church that used to exist in Japan and in India and were persecuted out of existence? What about the first Christian country, nation to be converted to Christ, Syria, which today is a stronghold of the Islamic faith? Do we know anything about that vast tract of Christian history? Why is it that Syria today is not a Christian country? Why is it that North Africa today, which once was one of the bastions of Christian truth, why is it that today it is under the domination of Islam? How did these things come to pass? And so that's the kind of lesson, you see, that we learn from these opening verses of this great psalm. It is that the Lord has always done great things for his people. So that is basically the teaching of verses 1 to 3 and the importance of listening. We have heard with our ears. We listened in order to learn. Our fathers have told us, and we were listening and we were enthralled by what they were saying, of what work thou didst in their days in the times of old. And then he goes on, as we've seen, how they'd drive out the heathen and brought in the victory that he was going to accomplish. It was his right arm. And the reason for it all at the end of verse 4 is because thou hast a favor unto them. This word favor means God's covenant faithfulness. It means that God looks at these people as different. He doesn't see them just as the heathen. He doesn't see them as ordinary. He sees them as related to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And down through the history of the Old Testament, we're told very clearly that it was according to the promises given to the fathers. That was why he was remaining faithful to this people, even when they would not be faithful to him, because he had promised Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And he was going to keep his promise to them, even although they would from time to time fail to keep their covenant loyalty to him. And it is because thou hast a favor unto them. And the gospel, the Bible makes it very clear, the gospel has one basic root. God has one great theme as to why he does such great things, and that is his love. It was because he loved them. I love you because I love you. And that is the reason why the Christian church exists today. It's not because we are great or strong or deserving. It is because God has set his love upon them. And again, in the reading in Romans chapter 8, those whom he has foreknown, he did also predestinate. The foreknowledge of God to certain people is ultimately the only explanation that we have thus far. We may have other explanations in heaven. Maybe he will tell us why he loved us. Maybe in the glory God will tell us why it is that he set his love upon us and not upon others. But at the present time, we're not told that. We are told that he loves his people, but we're not told why. We are given no reasons. He just says, I love you because I love you, and I set my love upon you. Well, that's the first thing, broadly speaking, in Psalm 44, but I better press on. From verse 4 to verse 8, we have the psalmist not only speaking about God in the past, but he's speaking about God in the present. And what he's saying is his own relationship to God in the present. This God, of whom he's been speaking in the opening verses, is the God whom he is speaking about in a most intimate personal relationship in verses 4 to 8. Thou art my God, my King, O God. Command deliverance for Jacob. Through thee we will push down our enemies. Through thy name we will tread them under that rise up against us. For I will not trust in my bow. He's learned the lesson from the past, you see. As the ancient fathers in Israel, they didn't put their trust in their bow or in their own sword. Neither shall my sword save me. It is God alone. But thou hast saved us from our enemies and put them to shame that hated us. In God we boast all the day long and praise thy name forever. And then there comes a pause in the psalm. Because as we're going to see from verse number 9, the psalmist begins to deal with a different kind of note altogether. It seems on the face of it to be a direct contradiction of what he has been saying in verses 4 to 8. Verses 10 to 16 seem to be the very opposite of what verses 4 to 8 are teaching. What are these verses 4 to 8? They are teaching that the God who in the past did great things because he had favor towards his people then is the God who is still doing great things for his people now because he has not changed. He has not changed. Circumstances have changed, and outward circumstances would suggest that maybe God has forgotten to be gracious. But the psalmist knows better than that. The psalmist knows that the God who was faithful in the past is still faithful in the present, even though it seems to a casual observer he doesn't seem to be faithful. Thou art my King, O God. He says, command deliverance for Jacob. He is asking God here, in a sense, to do for Jacob in the present what God had done for Jacob in the past. Israel, Jacob. In other words, give the victories in the present that you gave in the past. He is speaking in verse number 5 of his own personal submission and the national submission to this God. Through thee we will push down our enemies. Through thy name will we tread them under that rise against us. For I will not trust in my bow, neither shall my sword save me. But thou hast saved us from our enemies, hast put them to shame that hated us. In God we boast all the day long and praise thy name forever. Now you see, this is quite an extraordinary statement in the light of verses 9 to 16 and how we are counted as sheep for the slaughter. You see, mingling in with the suffering of God's people, that we have to remember always, it is not always a total defeat or a total demise of God's people. There is a tremendous tendency on the part of Israel of old and on the part of Christian people in our generation to look at our circumstances and to see perhaps only blackness, disappointment, defeat, decline, and to forget that the God who was doing great things in the past is still doing great things in the present. In our world today, there are probably millions of Christians. It has been estimated by missionary societies and people who study statistics on these things that there are probably more Christians in the world today than there have ever been in any single generation in the whole of history. Now, we're not saying that proportionately in Australia that there are more Christians proportionate to the population of Australia or Scotland or any other of our Western Christianized societies. We're not saying that. We're not even saying that in terms of the total population of the world, the proportion of Christians is greater than it's ever been. It may be declining proportionately. We don't know. But in terms of real numbers, there are multitudes and multitudes of Christian people. And we should remember that even if the door of salvation were to be closed, even tonight, right at this moment, the door of heaven is closed. No more salvation for anybody. It would still be true that in the glory there would be a great multitude whom no man can number. Millions and billions of Christian people already in the kingdom. Now, if that is the case, then does it matter really how many are against us ultimately? How are we ever going to accuse God of being impotent or losing his interest just because the enemy seems to be coming in like a flood and all the great spokespeople of the earth and all the beautiful people and the movers and the shakers and the controllers of this world's history, they all seem to be either atheists or in some way antagonistic, at least to the Christian gospel. And sometimes we are paralyzed because we are seeing the greatness of the enemy and at the same time we're not seeing the greatness of God. God is good and great to us today. And even if this congregation, for example, were to disappear from the face of the earth, that would not be the end of God's people. Now, you know that, and I know that. I'm simply pressing home a point. Let us not be dismayed. You see, the fact of the matter is this. The nation of Israel was never one of the mighty nations. It was always a minority group. They were a backward kind of people in comparison to some of the great empires around them. For example, they were taken out of Egypt as a slave people. Egypt was a mighty empire. Egypt had a high civilization. Abraham was called out of Ur of the Chaldees. And the archaeologists have dug up what they think is the Ur of the Chaldees and other of these southern Iraq, Mesopotamian cities. And they're astonished at the level of civilization. Agriculture, the astronomy, they could map the stars in those days, the Babylonians. They knew about agriculture. They had great skill in certain kinds of medicine and so on and so on. And in comparison to that, Israel was a rather backward place to be. And its greatness under David and Solomon didn't last very long, something like a century or something like that only. And then it was decline all the way in Israel. It was never a mighty nation. And that's why it was always easy meat for the Egyptians coming up from the south, for the Babylonians and the Assyrians coming down from the north, and then Rome just walked in and took over. And Alexander the Great, he was able to march right through the Jewish land, and he didn't have to do anything, really. He had to struggle against the Tyre and Sidon, against the Persians, but not against the Jews. It was an insignificant nation. And yet they can speak about God as being for them in a way that he wasn't for any other nation. You see, we tend to think, the world tends to think, rather, that big is beautiful. And we must learn that God looks upon his people and he sees them in their apparent insignificance and unattractiveness. Who would want to go and live in Israel? Nobody would want to leave one of these great empires to go and live in this backward little country with a strange God and these strange rules that they lived by. Nobody, there were no mass migrations into the people of Israel, but people wanted to go to Rome, they wanted to go to Babylon, they wanted to go to the great empire cities, but nobody particularly wanted to go to Jerusalem by choice. It was a backward place. Now, it's always been like that with God's people. We have always been the minority group. We have always been a voice, as it were, in a kind of a wilderness. Nobody has ever listened to God's people. Nobody listened to the prophets of Israel. Even the greatest prophets like Jeremiah. We know that hardly anybody even in Israel was listening to Isaiah. And Jeremiah was told to shut up as he was preaching in the gates of Jerusalem. And the first half of the message of Ezekiel, you remember, the first 25 chapters of Ezekiel, hardly anybody among the exiles was believing what he was saying, that the city was going to fall. They simply were a voice that people thought were strange and foolish. It's always been like that. And yet here is the psalmist saying that God's people, no matter what the apparent circumstances of life, recognize by faith that God has not changed. And in some way that we cannot begin to understand, even in bad times, God is still the same. And the psalmist is asking him to come and demonstrate, do again, give deliverance for Israel, or give deliverance for Jacob, and come and help us once again. So here we have God in the past and God in the present. We have to remember that. And especially as Christian people, we need to remember two things about Christ. One is, he says, I will build my church, and the gates of hell, Hades, will not prevail against it. And the other is in Hebrews chapter 13 at verse 8, Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. There are other things we should remember about him. But we should remember that his ongoing building of the church has never been dissuaded. He has never been discouraged. He has never had to cease or refresh his plans or to change his ways because of unseen adverse circumstances. No, no, no. I will build my church my way. And nothing can prevent it. And he's the same yesterday, today, and forever. He receives sinners and he eats with them today. He has been raised from the dead, never to die again. The same in the past and in the present. The same in the present as in the past. And then, very briefly, from verse 9 to 16, we have a sudden change of picture. Not speaking about God, but speaking about what God is doing in a seemingly contradictory and adverse way. Let's read these verses. But thou hast cast off and put us to shame and goest not forth with our armies. Why should the psalmist speak like this? Well, we're not sure of what the circumstances were. But when he says here, thou goest not forth with our armies, he is obviously speaking of some kind of military defeat that has taken place in the history of Israel. We don't know when it was. It may have been one of those times before David fully became king. We don't know. But it seems that there has been a war, and Israel has, as it was wont to do, going out to battle, perhaps overconfidently, the Lord is on our side, therefore we are going to scatter these heathen. And rather than us scattering the heathen, the psalmist is saying it's the heathen that's scattering us. Thou makest us to turn back from the enemy, and they which hate us, they make spoil of us for themselves. It's the picture of a defeated army fleeing before the victors. Thou hast given us like sheep appointed for meat and hast scattered us among the heathen. Some of them have been taken captive. They've been taken into exile. They are now being sold as slaves. Thou sellest thy people for next to nothing and dost not increase thy wealth by their price. In other words, they are being sold for the cheapest possible price. They are worthless. Even as slaves, they're of no great value. They are being treated with utter contempt. They are being mocked in their weakness and in their defeat. Thou makest us a reproach to our neighbors, a scorn and a derision to them that are round about. Thou makest us a byword among the heathen, a shaking of the head among the people. And the psalmist is speaking against the background of in those days, and indeed in present days as well, in some cultures, when an army goes out to war, the integrity, the credibility of the God of that nation is at stake. And if, in fact, Israel won the battle, then it would mean, even in the eyes of the defeated enemy, that the God of Israel was stronger than the God of Babylon or Assyria, whatever happened to be. And if, in fact, Israel was defeated, then it meant that these gods of these nations were stronger than the God of Israel. That's the way that people thought. That's the way that the heathen were thinking and mocking God's people in their defeat and in their demoralized condition is in fact mocking God himself. Now, we're living in a time not so very different from this. The Christian church seems to be defeated. All the arguments, all the evidence seems to be on the side of those who can explain how the world began and how human and other forms of life come from other forms of life. And all the arguments, you discuss with an evolutionist, why does he believe in evolution? He'll not only spend 10 minutes, he'll spend 10 hours or 10 days explaining to you why. He will point out the periods in history where the genome branches off, where the genes begin to separate. And they will tell you all sorts of things, and they sound so convincing, and we sometimes seem to be just so foolish, and we're left floundering. All the arguments seem to be so convincing. But it's always been like that. God's people have always been shown up to be weak and insufficient. Because the fact is, we are insufficient and we are weak. We don't know the answers to the questions that people are asking. There's no point in trying to explain things that we and they also don't even begin to understand. Thou makest us a byword among the heathen, a shaking of the head among the people. My confusion is continually before me, and the shame of my face has covered me. For the voice of him that reproaches and blasphemes by reason of the enemy and the avenger. Here is a man of faith, a man of God, and all he hears on the one hand is the moaning of Israel, the cries of a defeated nation. And the cries of victory, the cries of contempt, ridicule, and the mocking of those who seem to have won the battle, and Israel seems to be, as it were, no more, or on the point of being no more. There are those who tell us today that the Christian faith is simply, it's a matter of time, and it will be no more. We are an old Eastern religion. We have passed our use-by date. Christianity is declining in every single Western culture. Christian is declining. In some areas, in second and third world countries, it seems to be increasing, but not keeping pace with the population. And so on the whole, as A.N. Whitehead has said in his book, Science and the Modern World, for the past four centuries, religion has lost its hold on the Western mind. And I don't think anybody in their right mind would disagree with that general assessment. And in Australia, who would even begin to try to deny that? You've only to look at the few that are here tonight, and you can visit other congregations, and there may be more, there may be less. But nothing in comparison to the multitudes who are in the pubs and the clubs and the beaches and doing whatever they do. Nothing. We are just insignificant, a minuscule little group of strange people who believe strange things. And that's the importance of this psalm, you see. Because when Paul quotes from this psalm, what he's saying is nothing has changed. It's always been like this. God did great things for a little nation. And the nations round about, by and large, they would know, but they weren't all that impressed. Rahab in the city of Jericho, you remember in Joshua chapter 2 when the spies went and she received them and kept them safe. And you remember how in their conversation with her, she said, we have heard what your God has done. And out of all the people in Jericho, she was the only one who seems to have believed it. Jericho was straitly shut up. They locked their gates against the advancing Israelites. Everybody in Jericho could have been saved like Rahab if only they had believed that God had given to them, to Israel, the land. They knew what had happened to the kings of Moab and Bashan and other places. But they weren't all that impressed. Just another tribal god on the warpath. But Rahab, she believed. I know that your God has given to you this land. She believed the promise, you see. And she was saved. The Egyptians knew all about it. They make no record of the passing of Israel through the Red Sea and the destruction of their own army in the returning floods of the Red Sea. They make no mention of it. Just another one of those events, people coming and going. Nothing all that significant. An army being lost. Well, armies get lost all the time, don't they? Whole armies disappear and get drowned. That's nothing new. Soldiers die. It happens in warfare. And so God was doing great things for a few people. And that's why the psalmist in verses 4 to 8 speaks about his own submission to God. Come what may, let the enemy roar and boast and mock. Thou art my King, O God. And in the midst of such a devastating military defeat and a national humiliation, when Israel seemed to be on the verge of perhaps extinction, here is faith speaking. And as we shall see next week, God willing, the psalmist makes it very clear, this has not come upon us because we've been unfaithful. There's another reason. And the other reason is equally important. Indeed, it may well be even more important. And we'll see what that other reason is, God willing, next time. But you see the tremendous lessons, the relevance, the application. And you can see surely why it is that Paul, when he's quoting that great statement to clinch his argument in Romans chapter 8, would quote from this psalm. Because if there is ever a psalm that identifies with all generations of God's people, it's this one. That's why I said in my opening remarks, we could spend a lot of time in this psalm, because there are wide-ranging implications and applications. But I'll need to leave it at that point. Let us remember the past. Let us see the present with all its adversities and seeming victories. Let us recognize the reality of it. The enemies of the gospel, they've got reasons from their perspective. They've got reasons to boast. And yet at the same time, we have reasons as Christians still to submit and to worship God, to come before him and to say, Thou art my King, O God, and come what may, I will be submissive to this God. I will be submissive to the gospel. Because God doesn't change. Even when the fortunes of nations or churches change, God does not change. That's the important lesson. And we'll pick up on that, God willing, next time. Well, we'll leave it at that point this evening.